Hello and welcome to The Progress Theory, where we discuss scientific principles for optimizing human performance. I am Dr. Phil Price, and on today's episode, we are joined by a physiologist from Newcastle University, Dr. Callum Brownstein. Now, managing and recovering from fatigue is so important for the success of a training program and sporting performance. So if it's that important, we really should understand the mechanisms behind fatigue. And on top of that, we need to understand how different sports, different training modalities, and different training intensity, different training volumes, all influence the type of mechanisms behind fatigue. And if we can understand that, we can make better training programming decisions. As always, follow The Progress Theory on Instagram and YouTube and check out all of our other content. Here is Dr. Callum Brownstein. Are you a hybrid athlete who wants to learn more about how to combine your strength and endurance training? Well, I've written a new book, The Science of Hybrid Training. In this book, I provide insight into the misconceptions surrounding strength and endurance training by distilling the past 50 years of research and drawing on the conversations I had with great scientists, coaches, and athletes on the Progress Theory podcast. This book is essential reading for hybrid athletes and coaches who are looking to understand the key training variables and their effect on the simultaneous development of strength and endurance performance. Get your copy now, available to buy from Amazon. Now, let's get into the show. Hi, Callum, how are you? Thank you for coming on to The Progress Theory.
No problem. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Really good to have you on. I first heard of your work. Funnily enough, we have a TMS at St. Mary's University, and I've been asking one of our researchers there, Alex Woodhead, all about it because I wanted to learn more about fatigue. And then he provided me with some resources and with some slides and a PhD. And it was your PhD, which you must have, or a particular chapter from a PhD. I was like, okay. And then I heard your podcast on That Triathlon Show. I was like, okay, this is my turn now.
Right, brilliant. No, I'm happy to come on. Yeah, absolutely.
For those who are not familiar with the fatigue and research, do you want to just introduce yourself, like your sort of research background, that type of thing?
Yeah, sure. So I did my PhD at Northumbria University. So I finished that in 2018. And my PhD was in the area of, I'll call it neuromuscular fatigability. So the acute impairments in neuromuscular function occurring as a result of exercise. And in particular, was looking at recovery post-exercise after high-intensity intermittent team sport type exercise. So we were looking at football match play. The focus of the PhD was especially on changes occurring within the nervous system as a result of exercise, how they can perhaps contributed to fatigability, so to impairments in force and power generating capacity, and how long they took to recover post-exercise. Because prior to that, when we think about post-exercise fatigue and recovery, the focus had primarily been on sort of peripheral muscular changes and how long they take to recover. So mechanisms like muscle damage and glycogen depletion and inflammation. Whereas although we knew that the nervous system can contribute to fatigability, to impairments in force generating capacity during exercise, there hadn't been much research looking at that in terms of recovery, so how long those mechanisms took to recover following exercise. So that was what my PhD was in. So it was really a kind of neuromuscular neurophysiology focus. And then I moved across to France for 4 years, where I worked under the supervision of Professor Guillaume Millet. So I'd never really planned to move abroad, but the opportunity came up towards the end of my PhD. I knew of Guillaume's research really well. I knew we had really similar interests, and I knew that, it was a great opportunity to work in his lab because I knew how productive his labs were. And yeah, it was a really brilliant experience. Absolutely loved living in France and working in the lab. And during my postdoc, I probably transitioned a little bit. There was probably a phase in my postdoc when I was like, there was a lot of pure neurophysiology research going on in that lab, as well as exercise physiology research. So the neurophysiology research would be looking at kind of nervous system function and changes within the nervous system, but not necessarily in response to exercise. But it was really the exercise side of things that I was interested in. And so I probably transitioned a little bit away from just neurophysiology and starting to look more at the acute integrative responses to exercise with an emphasis on studying the neuromuscular system within a sort of integrative exercise physiology framework. So since then, my research sort of revolves around studying the acute responses to exercise, what limits the physiological responses to exercise, and again, studying fatigability in an integrative exercise physiology framework.
And now you're at Newcastle University, is that right?
Yes, yeah, I should add that. Yeah, so I took up a lecturing role at Newcastle University in September 2022. So yeah, usual lecturing post to do teaching and have plenty of time for research as well. So no, it's been really good since I've started here.
Did you play any particular sport growing up that led you to, well, towards the research around fatigue and physiology when it came to like starting your PhD?
I boxed competitively in amateur boxing when I was about 14, 15 years old. And it was probably that really got me interested in, I guess, physiology and sports science and kind of being curious about what are the sort of optimal ways to train. Because boxing's an individual sport, you obviously have to be very fit. I did often think with some of the training that I was doing back then when I was going to the boxing clubs that, say you'd have a two-hour session, you'd spend the first half hour skipping and you'd go on slow runs and stuff like that. And then you'd have a bout and it would be, you know, 3 2-minute rounds, very, very high intensity. So I was always like, well, what we're doing in training doesn't really replicate what we're doing when we compete. So I became kind of curious about it and so decided to do an undergrad in sports science. When I started my undergrad, I actually wanted to be a practitioner. So I wanted to work with athletes and I especially wanted to work in football because I was a big football fan. So I kind of worked towards that during my undergrad and ended up working at a football club in Edinburgh for a couple of years, so during the last year of my undergraduate. And then I did a master's by research with the football club. So that was at Heriot Watt University where the football team trains. And I enjoyed being a practitioner and kind of working with academy players, but I really enjoyed doing research. So whether that was, you know, with the players or my undergrad dissertation project. And I felt that that was the route that I wanted to go down. And then a PhD position became available at Northumbria and it was kind of, there were similarities or overlap for what I was doing during my master's by research. So yeah, I felt like that was a career path that I wanted to go down rather than being a practitioner.
Mm, that's cool to hear. When you said that your research really focused around sort of high intensity bouts of exercise and how, what type of fatigue is generated from that and how well we can recover from that, the first thing that came to my head is like, you've done a particular sport which involves sort of like high intensity movements for a particular amount of time. So when you talk about boxing and football, I was like, okay, it's sort of, you can always understand where people's sort of like research passions come from because something's happened before. Boxing makes a lot of sense, especially if it's like, you know, really intense bouts of work. So, well, what happens from that, you know? Because I realized earlier I said TMS and they're not exactly frequent. Can we start at the beginning? And then would you be able to just kind of give like a base understanding of the difference between, let's say, central fatigue and peripheral fatigue?
All right. So I suppose the way that I try and think about it and the way I try and encourage my students to think about it is there's lots of sort of debate on how to define fatigue. But let's just say for the purposes of today that fatigue is a reduction in the force generating capacity of the muscle. So you ask someone to contract with as much force as possible before and after exercise, and there's a reduction in how much force could be generated, or maybe maximal power, depending on how you're measuring it. So the way I try and think about it is, in order to understand what contributes to muscle fatigue in response to exercise, you need to understand what the mechanisms of a muscle contraction are, because it's the interference with those mechanisms that contributes to muscle fatigue, reduction in force generating capacity. And a muscle contraction begins in the nervous system. That's where those signals are initiated. We have an area of our brain called the motor cortex, and that's the area from which descending signals are sent from the brain to the spinal cord, where they then activate what are called alpha motor neurons in the spinal cord. And those motor neurons project to the muscle, they kind of branch and they innervate a given number of muscle fibers. So a motor neuron and the muscle fibers that that motor neuron innervates are called a motor unit. So for example, if we're talking about the quadriceps, there'll be, you know, several hundred motor units. Each motor unit will have several hundred, sometimes maybe over 1,000 muscle fibers within each motor unit. So we've got a signal coming from the brain to the motor neuron, to the motor units. That signal then projects to the muscle, it reaches the muscle, and then it initiates a cascade of events in the muscle, which lead to a muscle contraction. If we're talking about central fatigue, this refers to reductions in the capacity of the nervous system to activate the muscle. The strength, if you like, of those neural signals going from the brain to the muscle are reduced, and that means we're unable to activate the muscle completely. And that can contribute to reductions in muscle force generating capacity. So that's what we would term central fatigue. And then peripheral fatigue, so impairments in contractile function, this is a reduction in the capacity of the muscle to respond to those nervous system signals. So once the nervous system signal arrives at the muscle fiber, it initiates those cascade of events, which results in the generation of force. And if there's impairments or changes occurring within the muscle itself, then that can also contribute to a reduction in force generating capacity. So those are the two general mechanisms of muscle fatigue. But then, like I say, they're general mechanisms. So there's a lot of things going on. There can be a lot of different mechanisms within the nervous system that could contribute to a reduction in voluntary activation. And there's a lot of different mechanisms going on within the muscle that could contribute to peripheral fatigue and impairment in contractile function. And the way that we can measure that, so we can measure those two general mechanisms. And the way that we do that is using electrical stimulation of the motor nerve. So usually if we're looking at kind of whole body exercise like cycling or running, the quadriceps are usually the muscles that we focus on, so the knee extensor muscles, because they play a central role in activities like running and cycling, and they incur a lot of fatigue in response to those types of exercise for high intensity or prolonged. So the way that we do that is we stimulate the motor nerve, and that would be the femoral nerve if we're talking about the quadriceps, because that's the nerve through which signals are sent to activate the quadriceps muscles. So the way that we measure voluntary activation is we have participants perform what's called an isometric contraction. So that's when they're trying to extend their knee, but it's against an immovable object, and you're measuring how much force is generated during that isometric contraction. So we have them produce as much force as they possibly can. And when they're at their peak force, so when you see the plateau in the signal, you then deliver an electrical stimulation to the motor nerve, so to the femoral nerve if it's the quadriceps. If the nervous system isn't activating the muscle completely through that voluntary contraction, then when we stimulate, there'll be what's called a superimposed twitch. So there'll be additional force evoked on top of the voluntary force. And that tells us that the nervous system has been unable to activate the muscle completely. If the size of that additional force that we get on top of the voluntary force with the stimulation increases, for example, in response to exercise, that tells us that there's been a reduction in the capacity of the nervous system to activate the muscle. So that tells us about that nervous system component of muscle fatigue. And then what we do is we have participants relax straight after that maximal contraction, and we deliver the same electrical stimulation, but this time at rest. And again, that will evoke what's called a resting twitch response. So this time, there's no input from the nervous system because the participants are relaxing. So they're at rest, and the stimulation is traveling from the motor nerve to the muscle, and we get that twitch. And if there's a reduction in the size of that twitch, then that tells us that there's impairments in contractile function. So that would be our measure of peripheral fatigue. And so together we can use these methods to quantify muscle fatigue through the reduction in the maximal force and those two general mechanisms through voluntary activation and the rested twitch response.
Oh, that's really cool. This type of physiological testing and measuring fatigue, and both for central and peripheral mechanisms. I mean, that's been done for quite some time in terms of looking at different sports and different volumes and intensities of work. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think especially in the, you know, the last 20 years, there's been a lot of research out there. You know, prior to kind of in the 90s and before that, there'd been plenty of research using these methods, but they had primarily been done using isometric exercise. So obviously, when even if we're looking at whole body exercise using these methods, we're quantifying muscle fatigue using isometric contractions because it's a very valid and reliable way to measure muscle fatigue, and we can implement these stimulation methods. But kind of in the 90s and before, they were using isometric exercise to induce fatigue. And it was probably only since the millennium that, since after the millennium, that a lot more research has gone into measuring muscle fatigue in response to more ecologically valid types of exercise, like endurance running and cycling and team sports. And the types of activities that people would perform on a daily basis.
Especially quite a lot of the literature that I've been particularly interested in have talked a lot around the differences in fatigue that's been evoked if you did cycling over running. So I guess I've been reading a lot around concurrent training and around, you know, the combination of strength and endurance training. And there's a lot around, well, if you don't want to have some kind of interference effect, maybe you should choose cycling over running because of the fatigue response. What are the like main differences in fatigue response if you compare cycling and running? And I realize that's quite a broad question because with each sport comes with different intensities and volumes, but what are the main differences between those two modalities?
Really, one of the central areas in this research looking at fatigability in response to whole body exercise, just any type of exercise really, is what's called task dependency. And that basically refers to the magnitude of mechanisms contributing to muscle fatigue differ depending on the characteristics of exercise that we perform. So that can be, you know, the exercise intensity, the exercise duration, or like you're referring to in cycling versus running, the exercise modality. So all of these factors can have an influence on, again, the magnitude and the mechanisms contributing to muscle fatigue. So we did a study a couple of years ago. It was one of the last studies I did during my postdoc where we tried to address that question of what are the differences in fatigue or the magnitude and, again, magnitude and mechanisms of fatigue between running and cycling. So we recruited, they were primarily triathletes, so they were people who were very much familiar with both modalities. So we had two separate visits where they performed 3 hours of cycling during one visit, 3 hours of running during another visit. And importantly, we matched the intensity, and obviously the duration was 3 hours, but it was important to match the exercise intensity between the two modalities. It kind of, if we didn't do that appropriately, then, you know, you're confounded by differences in the intensity. So we had them cycle and run. It was just above the lactate threshold. So it was 105% lactate threshold, or we measured it using gas exchange. So it was a gas exchange threshold. And then we quantified, using those methods that I described, muscle fatigue and voluntary activation. So that's central fatigue element, and contractile function, that peripheral fatigue element. We measured that pre-exercise, halfway through exercise, so at an hour and a half, and post-exercise. And so the results were quite interesting because we found that muscle fatigue, so the magnitude of the reduction in the force generating capacity of the knee extensors, so muscle fatigue, was very similar between the two modalities. So there was no difference between the reduction in force generating capacity. It was something like 25%, around about that. But the mechanisms that contributed to that decrement were very much different between the two modalities. So in cycling, we found quite substantial reductions in the resting twitch response and some reduction in voluntary activation as well. But it looked like that the fatigue incurred from cycling was primarily a result of mechanisms within the muscle. And in contrast, in response to running, we actually found very little decrement in the resting twitch responses, so that peripheral fatigue element, but really quite substantial reductions in voluntary activation. I guess the results suggested that both cycling and running at a given intensity and duration incur similar magnitudes of muscle fatigue, but the mechanisms differ. Nervous system contributors to muscle fatigue are relatively more important in response to running, whereas those peripheral mechanisms seem to be more important in response to cycling. Yeah, there was really quite clear differences there, so it was interesting.
That's really interesting how very different mechanisms or different proportion of mechanisms, yet the output was still the same. There's still around that 25% decrement in force production. I do wonder if this might be quite individual, but is there a type of mechanism which we recover from more quickly? So for example, in that study you described where you had 3 hours of running and 3 hours of cycling, because the cycling had more peripheral mechanisms, would you recover faster because they are peripheral fatigue recovers quicker, or the other way around, more central factors recover quicker, or is it more of the same?
It would have been interesting to have measured recovery. We didn't measure recovery in that study. I mean, I think that recovery is probably more prolonged in response to running versus cycling, because you've got those, it's a much higher mechanical demand in response to running. You incur quite a lot of muscle damage in response to running. So I suppose the way I try and think about recovery is, what are the mechanisms that contribute to muscle fatigue and how long do those take to dissipate? So I think that in response to cycling, you know, if we had taken a biopsy from the quadriceps after that 3 hours of cycling, we probably would have found very low muscle glycogen levels. And, you know, with appropriate nutrition and taking plenty of carbohydrates on board, I would imagine that around 24 hours, maybe 48 hours later, that would have returned to baseline. And that was probably, I think, one of the main mechanisms contributing to that impairment in contractile function that we were seeing in response to cycling. Again, with appropriate nutrition, I think after metabolically demanding exercise with a lower mechanical demand, glycogen resynthesis is relatively rapid and your recovery of neuromuscular function is relatively rapid. Whereas in response to running, because you're incurring a lot of muscle damage, which takes much longer to recover, you'll still have a lot of glycogen depletion, but that muscle damage that you're incurring also interferes with glycogen resynthesis. So yeah, I think definitely recovery is more prolonged following running-based exercise as a result of those higher mechanical demands.
No, that does make sense. I would always compare it to, especially say, concurrent training, which have found like a decrement in strength performance. And it kind of makes sense as, yes, you've got different, I guess, mechanisms at play when you've got different modalities when it comes to fatigue. But I mean, assuming, and this is probably a follow-up question, if you did very high intensity strength work, that would place a large demand on possible fatigue mechanisms of the central nervous system or more central factors, because the mechanisms are similar for running and sort of high intensity strength work. That's why it might affect high intensity strength work more than say cycling, which the mechanisms are more geared towards peripheral.
I'm not an expert in this kind of resistance training research, but you do often hear about people sort of equating high intensity strength training and the central fatigue induced by that. But to be honest, I don't really know of any research that's really looked at that or actually demonstrated that it's the case. But I think, you know, heavy resistance exercise in this, similar to running, will induce a lot of muscle damage, which again will take more prolonged period to recover from. And there is also research showing that muscle damage per se can have quite a strong influence, inhibitory influence on the nervous system. So you've got studies which use, you know, eccentric damaging protocols. So these are protocols designed to destroy the muscle, basically just evoke as much damage as possible. And then they use these sort of methods that I've described previously. They quantify kind of central fatigue. And reductions in voluntary activation can take quite a long time to recover after that sort of exercise, sometimes, you know, 2 to 3 days. So yeah, I think heavy bouts of resistance exercise, which induce a lot of muscle damage, can induce quite substantial and quite prolonged impairments in nervous system function, definitely.
It's interesting that there seems to be a direction of research which is yet to be trodden or we don't fully understand at the moment. That's really cool. I'm going to interrupt here because I wanted to share with you the Progress Theory newsletter. If you want the latest information and recommendations on how to optimize your physical and mental performance, then subscribe to the free Progress Theory newsletter on Substack today. Click the link in the show notes and subscribe to get the best information on human performance sent straight to your email. Now, back to the podcast. There's another particular study I remember, and it looked at cycling intervals, and I guess peripheral and central fatigue factors were measured after each interval. And I just remember this very clearly, that after each interval, peripheral mechanisms of fatigue were increasing kind of steadily, and central fatigue mechanisms were kind of near zero. They, you know, weren't really contributing much. And then once they reached almost like a certain threshold of number of intervals, central factors just went, like exponentially went up.
Yeah.
So I assumed there's always this relationship between intensity and volume when it comes to different factors that play when it comes to fatigue. Is that something that you found in the research as well, that when it comes to sort of low intensity versus high intensity, you get different responses, but when you do high volumes of high intensity, all of a sudden both factors, both peripheral and central mechanisms, increase quite a lot?
Yeah, I think I know exactly the study that you're referring to as well. I think that was one of Guillaume's postdoc supervisors, where they looked at the kind of fatigue during high-intensity intervals.
Oh, vividly.
Yeah. So that's very much consistent finding throughout the literature, no matter where you look. Studies that measure sort of the kinetics of fatigability will, during not necessarily prolonged, because that wasn't prolonged exercise, but there were quite a few intervals, you will almost always find that those peripheral mechanisms, so those reductions in rest and twitch responses, they occur very early during exercise. And then they'll often reach a kind of nadir, so they'll stop decreasing. At that point, you then generally see reductions in voluntary activation. So the reductions in voluntary activation in that nervous system component of muscle fatigue more kind of predominate when exercise is more prolonged. So there's a relationship between exercise duration and reductions in nervous system voluntary activation. So the longer the exercise is, generally, the greater the reductions in voluntary activation. What's interesting is that we don't really know why that's the case at all, I would say. Like, you kind of, people might speculate about different things, but I would say that we don't really know why that occurs. The nervous system is not as easy to study as the muscle, because you can take a biopsy of the muscle, you can use other methods like magnetic resonance spectroscopy, where you can look at what's going on inside the muscle during exercise. You can't take a biopsy of the nervous system, obviously. So it's much harder to work out, you know, what's going on. We can use other methods. So one of them you mentioned earlier is TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. We can do spinal electrical stimulation. So we can kind of try and probe what's going on within the nervous system by stimulating the nervous system at different sites. But we don't really know why it is that reduction of voluntary activation occur or become greater as exercise duration increases. But there's, you know, lots of evidence showing that that's the case. And then in terms of those peripheral mechanisms, they certainly become more, they become greater as exercise intensity increases. And sort of a very important threshold for peripheral fatigue is the maximal metabolic steady state, which we often measure with critical power. So when we go above that critical power into the severe, what we'd call the severe intensity domain, because there's these substantial and rapid metabolic perturbations. So there's these increases in metabolite concentrations, so things like inorganic phosphate or ions like hydrogen, which contribute to peripheral fatigue. You know, the muscle will fatigue at a rapid rate as a result of those mechanisms. So yeah, definitely intensity and duration have an important influence over those kind of general mechanisms of muscle fatigue.
Are there any practical recommendations that have come from that research to the point where you kind of want to train hard, but not to the point of too intense, or when you get to that nadir, so that you can kind of train more frequently? Yeah, has there been any practical recommendations come from your ability to recover from different mechanisms?
You know, there's a lot of stuff out there at the moment on I don't know what they call it, zone two training and all that. And basically keep your easy days easy and make your hard days hard sort of thing. And yeah, some of the research we've done has looked at the relationship between exercise intensity and muscle fatigue. And we did a study a couple of years ago looking at fatigue around the lactate threshold, or we measure it with gas exchange, the gas exchange threshold. So that's the intensity above which blood lactate will increase for the first time. So it's the boundary between moderate and heavy intensity exercise. So that would kind of be, I guess, well, you've got all these different zone models, but if zone two was just below that threshold, and then zone three was kind of in the heavy domain just above it. So what we found was that when you cross that threshold quite early during exercise, muscle fatigue is kind of compounded and quite substantially greater than when we're just below that threshold. So even, yeah, being above that threshold for a really fairly brief period of time causes kind of exacerbated muscle fatigue. So I guess a practical takeaway from that is it kind of re-emphasizes that keeping your easy days easy, and if you're on a sort of what you call a recovery run, just being disciplined with your exercise intensity to preserve your energy and your physiological function, if you like, for those higher intensity sessions, because probably the recovery cost of crossing that threshold for even relatively brief periods of time is going to be greater versus if you stay below that threshold.
Now, that does line up with a lot of what is being perpetrated out there regarding keep your easy days easy, and how many people, especially in running, they end up not running intensely, but they run their easy days too hard. So they're like stuck in that zone three heavy domain. So they're just compounding that fatigue and never really do anything easy. They think their easy days are easy, but they're not. They never actually have an easy day. And so that compounding fatigue just builds up over time, and that's where the problems happen.
Absolutely.
It's all coming together, it seems. All they're saying, and the research supports that, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you have any other practical recommendations in terms of how to organize a training week based on, you know, your intense days and your easy days, based on how well you know that we recover from certain exercises, certain intensities, that type of thing?
Yeah, I think it's probably doesn't have to be rocket science, to be honest. I think, so myself, I'm definitely not an endurance athlete, but I will make sure that I'm as fresh as possible for those high intensity days. So for those days when I'm spending time in the severe domain, I'm doing high intensity intervals or, you know, a 5K run, I'll make sure that I'm as fresh as possible going into those days. So it might be that the day before I'll have a day off, or it might be that, again, I would do a sort of moderate intensity run in the days before that. So I think it's just, but some of it is trial and error, knowing how long it takes you to recover from certain types of sessions. But, and I think once you kind of know yourself when, how long it roughly takes you to recover from certain times of sessions, and so that you feel at your best going into those high intensity sessions. So it's very individual though. So I would say it's hard to give, you know, very kind of prescribed guidance. But yeah, I would say just ensuring that you're as recovered as possible for those high intensity kind of red zone sessions by, yeah, again, making your easy days easier in the lead up to that, really.
There's something that's quite popular in the training space at the moment where you are deliberately trying to elicit a form of fatigue, which I believe is more of a peripheral fatigue, where you would train movements which are similar to, say, running. So you're doing squats, lunges, all of those types of things. And you're kind of lightweights training to failure in a circuit type of training. And then you're utilizing that fatigue to then do your long endurance session the next day. So the idea is that you're kind of like running on fatigued legs. And it's a strategy I've seen people use as a way of, well, I want to get better at my long distance running, but I don't have the time to run as much as a long distance runner. And I'm usually a bit more heavy. So I'm using this strategy of pre-fatigue to try and use that when I do my long runs. And then once I sort of reach a particular race or something like that, and I start to ease off the pre-fatigue and stuff, and I start to go in more fresh to these long runs, I then carry that fitness and I've actually improved. Have you ever heard of sort of like a pre-fatiguing type of exercise strategy? And do you think that would be beneficial for, let's say, long-term endurance performance for athletes that might be a little bit heavier, or, you know, they're not just runners?
I can't really say that I've heard that strategy in particular. I suppose what it makes me think about is there was a lot of stuff coming from David Bishop's lab. So he does a lot of research on mitochondrial adaptations to endurance exercise. One of the things that he looked at was looking at kind of double sessions, basically. So training twice within one day, which I guess is somewhat similar, because you'd be probably going into that session with some degree of fatigue. So yeah, I know that some of that research has shown that the mitochondrial adaptations can be enhanced through doing double sessions, so two sessions within one day, relative to kind of performing this the same number of sessions in a week, but not two in one day, so more spread out. So I guess what it makes me think is that, you know, it's maybe not any positive adaptations coming from that are maybe not as a result of fatigue per se, of going into a session fatigue per se. It's probably just you're increasing the kind of training volume becomes higher by doing those sort of double sessions or going into a session fatigue because you've recently done a session. And there's positive adaptations associated with that, which probably is as a result of fatigue per se, but probably as a result of the high training volume. As a physiologist, I always focus on the physiology, obviously, but maybe there could be some benefits in terms of, you know, training under fatigue. There's perhaps psychological benefits of that because, you know, eventually during a race, especially if you're doing more prolonged distances like ultramarathons, at some point you're going to, you know, have to run over quite extreme fatigue. So there's perhaps some psychological benefits of having done that at certain phases of kind of your training cycle. I think there can be benefits there.
No, that's really interesting. And, you know, you're seeing it more and more with, especially with elite athletes, they're getting so good, but they seem to be able to recover so quickly for such high training volumes. And training volumes are so high that they are doing like double session, triple sessions per day. You're like, is that fatigue just completely building? And now people are utilizing it specifically because they believe that that's going to lead to a specific adaptation. So it's interesting what you're saying, but, you know, you're deriving fatigue, but isn't the fatigue that might be causing the improvements? It's just providing like an environment for something else. So yeah, that's really interesting to start think about. That's really cool.
Yeah. So what I suppose it's, you know, fatigue is just an inevitable consequence of having such a high training volume, but I don't think it's the fatigue per se that's eliciting the adaptation. There's perhaps like overlap between mechanisms that are contributing to muscle fatigue and mechanisms that are initiating those kind of intramuscular, intracellular signals that are eliciting the adaptations, if that makes sense. So in order to improve and elicit those adaptations, muscle fatigue is sort of inevitable.
Mm. Callum, that was absolutely amazing. You really did answer my questions, and I've got a list here that I've literally just gone through. Everything has been absolutely great. Thank you for all of that information. Where can people reach you, especially when it comes to like you put up your research?
Yes, so I always put my research on Twitter. So Twitter handle is at CG Brownstein. So yeah, you can find me on Twitter, and I always put all my research there. You can find a link to my ResearchGate there as well. So those would be the main channels.
Yeah, brilliant. And if anyone's wanting to learn more about fatigue and all of that, please definitely check out those pages. I found a lot of great work on your Google Scholar page as well. And yeah, I recommend if you're interested in fatigue, especially around how you might be able to derive some practical applications in terms of how you order your training week, et cetera, definitely check out that work. But Callum, yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
No problem. Thanks a lot for having me on, Phil.
Before we wrap up, I want to give a shout out and my thanks to my production partner, Cult Media. If you are thinking of launching a podcast or want to grow your audience, head to www.cult.media, that's cult with a K, to get started today.